Hey folks, my name is Carly Berlin, and I'm the New Orleans Metro reporter at WWNO and WRKF. Earlier this year, I had the chance to report on the city council's move to tear out 2 miles of protected bike lanes in Algiers. Before the council came to a vote, I wanted to see these bike lanes for myself. So I asked a few people from the neighborhood to take me on a bike ride there. In the story, you can hear the wheels of our bikes turning, and you can also hear car drivers whizzing past us on the other side of the plastic bollards that the city has since voted to take out. That is the power of radio to me, taking you, the listener, out into the field, maybe to places you know well or have never been. So please donate what you can so that we can keep bringing you the kinds of stories that you want to hear. You can donate by going to our websites, WWNO and WRKF.org, or call 844-790-1094. You can make a one-time contribution or become a sustaining member. Thank you for supporting local journalism. Now, here's the show.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. On the show today, the Hill Memorial Library at Louisiana State University recently unveiled a new exhibition focused on the state's wetlands. We learn more about the history of the relationship between Louisianans and the water we rely on in the exhibition dubbed Water, Water Everywhere, Control and Consequence in Louisiana's Coastal Wetlands. But first, nearly 40 years after devastating floods upended their lives, nearly 2,000 Louisiana residents in Tangipahoa Parish are now closer than ever to financial restitution from the state over flooding caused by the construction of Interstate 12. A legislative committee last month approved a $95 million payment to the more than 1,200 victims, 400 families, 96 businesses in Tangipahoa Parish for damages suffered in the April 1983 flood. Jean-Paul Larrison is one of the attorneys representing the flood victims. He joins me now. Jean-Paul, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome, Karen. Glad to be here.
It looks like the victims of this flood from 39 years ago are finally going to get restitution. It's such a long time in the making. There have been many starts and stops along the way, beginning with proving that the construction of I-12 even caused the flooding. Would you describe what happened?
Yeah. So in the April of 1983, I was actually a senior in high school in Ponchatoula when this happened. But there was a terrible flood that flooded 400 families and like you said, 96 businesses in Tangipahoa Parish. When I-12 was built in the 1970s, and I-12 is sort of a shortcut between Slidell and Baton Rouge for I-10 that keeps it from dipping in New Orleans. But when it was constructed, when Tangipahoa Parish had to cross the Tangipahoa River north of Ponchatoula, south of Robert, the Tangipahoa River, under normal circumstances, is a scenic, beautiful river that may be 50 yards wide, 100 yards wide, but its floodplain is almost a mile long. And the floodplain, of course, is what it needs when we have torrential rains and hurricanes and whatnot, when the rivers, these rivers flood on the North Shore. Well, when they constructed I-12, they didn't do the proper backwater analysis that when the state constructed it. And they essentially blocked 78% of the natural drain, the natural floodplain. So with the flood of 1983, what happened was that water backed up. And not only did it overflow the banks, but it actually changed course. The river jumped its track and went down a little bitty creek called Big Branch. And it flooded people who'd never, ever flooded before and had never had any flood insurance and that lived miles from the river. That's when the lawsuit began, and we were able to prove through experts and engineers that the work in building the relief structures and the bridge that crossed the floodplain were incorrectly done.
Right. And these are, as you mentioned, flood victims. They didn't have flood insurance because they'd never flooded. They'd never been in danger of flooding until the construction of I-12. And it took them quite some time even to prove that it was the I-12 construction that caused the flooding. a jury ruled in their favor in 1999, and still, more than a decade later, no money.
Well, it's interesting, Karen, because it's a class action. So first the class had to be certified, and that was appealed. And then the case was bifurcated between liability and damages. So the case on liability was tried in the late 90s and won, and the state appealed it to the First Circuit, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And then the damage trial took place, and that was appealed to the First Circuit and all the way to the Supreme Court. So the state fought us tooth and nail on every phase of the case and through every appellate step that they could. So the case took a really long time to get through the system. February 2006, it became a final judgment in favor of these flood victims against the state. And that's when we thought we would get paid, and we basically started over again trying to get paid.
And the rub in this is the authority to designate the money for the payment lies with the legislature. What have been the challenges there?
Well, so Louisiana in the 1970s waived the theory of sovereign immunity, meaning that the state could be sued, but they only did it partially. So you can sue the state and you can get a judgment or the state or a political subdivision, but you don't have the right to compel payment. I can't go seize a state building to pay my clients. You can't seize the state's bank accounts like you could a normal person. And so the only way you can get paid is if you can get the legislature to authorize and make the payment. It's a waiver of sovereign immunity, which goes back to suing the king, but it's a partial waiver.
Jean-Paul, what has this process been like for the families and businesses? And I know that not even all of the plaintiffs are still alive.
It really has been frustrating. When we won the case and it was finally a final decision, we had no idea that it would take this long to get it resolved. Tangipahoa Parish is very rural where this flooding took place. So a lot of the families, believe it or not, are still there. Sadly, some of the head of households have passed away, maybe 30 to 40% of the head of households, which is very tragic. But their families are still there, their kids and their grandkids. And they're very excited at the possibility of this finally being over.
We're speaking with Jean-Paul Larrison, one of the attorneys representing Tangipahoa Parish victims of flooding caused nearly 40 years ago by the building of Interstate 12. Jean-Paul, do you think it helped that Governor John Bel Edwards is from Tangipahoa Parish? While he's governor, the legislature was finally willing to resolve this lawsuit.
Yes, Governor Edwards and his staff have been very supportive. As we talked about earlier, though, the burden is on the legislature to pay judgments, not the governor. Practically, though, unless the governor is for you, you're not going to get paid because the governor has enough contacts in the legislature and he can put you in his budget. Governor Edwards was tremendous. I will say this. When he first got elected, he made it very clear to us that the state was broke and that he had to handle teachers and he had to handle hospitals. And he had to, you know, before he could try to find money in his budget to help us. And we patiently waited and he kept his word and has been a supporter of our clients being paid the last several years when the state finally had a surplus again.
The payment was approved last month without dissent by the Joint Legislative Committee on the Budget, which includes House and Senate leaders. So you did have large support finally. Can you tell us about the final agreement?
This proposed settlement is a one-time payment to go into the bank with the $6.5 million we had from the Jindal administration for a total settlement of $101.5. But because it doesn't count on future payments, I think that's why we got the legislative support that we got, because it's a definitive final agreement. The legislature is no longer bound. If the plaintiffs accept the settlement and the court approves it, it's over and done.
Jean-Paul Larrison, one of the attorneys representing Tangipahoa Parish victims of flooding caused nearly 40 years ago by the building of Interstate 12. Jean-Paul, thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate it.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. In early September, the Hill Memorial Library at Louisiana State University unveiled a new exhibition focused on the state's wetlands, dubbed Water, Water Everywhere, Control and Consequence in Louisiana's Coastal Wetlands. The exhibition tells the history of the relationship between Louisianans and water while drawing attention to the fragility of the state's coastal wetlands, largely due to human activity. Here to tell us more about this exhibition and what attendees can learn from it is LSU Libraries Exhibition Manager Leah Wood Jewett. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we're also joined by Tracy Quirk, Associate Professor at LSU's College of the Coast and Environment. Thank you also for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Leah, where did the idea come from to tell the story of the relationship between Louisianans and the water we rely on to tell it through an exhibition?
Yes. Special Collections holds materials that reflect on our diverse cultural heritage and history. And of course, the coast is an integral part of that. So over the years, researching our materials for a number of projects, it became very evident that this was a line running through the whole history of the collections.
All righty. And so how were you able to put it all together and timeline? I mean, what time period are we looking at this relationship between people and water?
It's a very broad timeline. It's basically historic settlement of Louisiana up through modern times. And we focus on the people of Louisiana, the way people have made a living here, flooding, flood control efforts, the industries that have benefited from flood control and have made an impact on the landscape, like agriculture, timber, and oil.
I understand that there are records on display that indicate enslaved and imprisoned people were forced to do labor on the wetlands. What's the story there?
Early on, with the beginning of European settlements in Louisiana, it became apparent that something had to be done with flooding to control the waterways. And unfortunately, enslaved people were the first on the line. After that, you had people who were imprisoned were forced to do labor on levees. And that went on for a very long time. It's a very painful and very important part of the story.
Okay, Tracy, so we have this exhibition and it does look at the past and it's a bit of a tortured past of Louisiana's history with water. Can you tell us how it relates with what we're dealing with right now?
Yeah, I mean, humans have been intimately involved in river management for as long as we've sort of colonized areas and wanted to live near rivers because they're a source of food and navigation and travel, transport. But over the last 7,000 years, the Mississippi River was very dynamic, shifted course, had side channels, oxbows, and where it met the Gulf of Mexico created large deltas. And whenever there was an active delta that was sort of abandoned by the river, it would form these large freshwater wetlands. And wherever it shifted course into the Gulf of Mexico began to deteriorate, and that's sort of a natural process. And we who have colonized near rivers have, benefited from being close to them, but also haven't wanted to, have the effects of flooding. And so really starting as early as the 1700s started levying the river. And that, especially after the Great Flood of 1927, when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers really started to install some major levees that essentially cut off the floodplain from the river. It benefited people because that has been effective in flood control, but has come at major ecological costs in terms of wetlands, including deltaic wetlands.
And of course, here in Louisiana, there's so much talk even of late of rebuilding wetlands and what that means. And I assume you would like to believe you learn from the past. Is there anything that we've learned from what we've seen happen in the past that we can move forward and do better with?
So in terms of what we're doing now, regionally and locally, I mean, we're facing major risk with sea level rise, subsidence, and some of our the results of our engineering of the rivers and impacts to wetlands, including oil and gas impacts. But you know, the state has a major coastal master plan, the Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. And this plan is revised every 5 years, and it includes a variety of strategies, such as risk reduction and protection, wetland and barrier island restoration, and even river diversions, where essentially the plan is to cut a hole through the levee and allow river water and sediment to flow into deteriorating wetland basins. But there's definitely a need for an adaptation plan that includes retreat from the coast. And there are low-lying areas that eventually will become extremely costly to maintain as sea level rises and the risks of disasters such as major storm surges from hurricanes become even greater.
I'd like to speak about what we have related to that as well in the exhibition. Dr. Quirk was talking about the diversion and sedimentation. We have reports back over 50 years or so that are still being used in current plans. So that's part of why we are putting on this exhibition, so that even modern day researchers and policymakers can use those materials to help make decisions for the future.
Leah, what has stuck out most to you in working on this exhibition? I would even wonder, as you looked at the different elements of this exhibition, how it hits you to think we're doing the same thing over 100 years later. We're still doing the same things to try to combat the coastal wetland loss and dealing with floods.
The best way I can say it is it's fascinating and heartbreaking at the same time. What has had the most impact with me is seeing the faces of mostly men who were working in the wetlands, trying to make a living for their family, and then also those working on the levees and reading descriptions of the conditions that they're working under. In many cases, they were working on the levees while it's flooding. So it's very, very dangerous work. And I feel that it's very important to remember their sacrifices. We get caught up in the science, which obviously is very important, but I think we need to remember the human side as well.
You mentioned this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act. How far do you think we've come when it comes to improving our connection to the water? And what do you think we can do to continue to nurture and improve this relationship?
Yeah, I think with the EPA and the regulatory environment, our water quality has improved over the last, you know, when we think about centuries, but there's also been an added pressure with increasing population sizes and changes in habitats. You know, there's fewer wetlands to facilitate water quality improvement and take up pollutants because of nutrient runoff from the agricultural land. That's the breadbasket of America. So we still have major water quality issues.
LSU Libraries Exhibition Manager Leah Wood Jewett and Associate Professor at the LSU College of Coast and Environment Tracy Quirk. The exhibition Water, Water Everywhere, Control and Consequence in Louisiana's Coastal Wetlands is free and open to the public. It's open through December 21st. Thank you both for joining us here on Louisiana Considered.
Thank you.
The collapse of Jackson, Mississippi's city water system earlier this month made headlines all over the world. But for residents, this is just the most recent example of water infrastructure issues that have plagued the city. Hundreds of lawsuits over lead exposure have piled up in the last year. From the Gulf States newsroom, Danny MacArthur has the latest.
A citywide boil water notice was lifted a little over a week ago. Before that, a failure at the city's main water treatment plant meant many residents didn't have water at all. Add in flooding, and you've got thousands going 7 weeks without access to clean water. And Nikki Martin is tired of it.
These past few years has been the worst ever being here this long.
Recently, Martin joined hundreds of other parents and their kids at the Mississippi Children's Museum for an update on another problem, the status of hundreds of lawsuits filed against city and state leaders for exposing them to lead. Martin has lived in Jackson for decades. It's where she's raising her two kids, who are 8 and 14 years old. But the city's recent water troubles have made her rethink calling Jackson home.
The water is the reason why I don't even want to buy a house here in Jackson.
The lawsuits were first filed in 2021. They've grown to include about 1,800 kids, who attorneys say have been exposed to lead by the city's water system. The lawsuits seek legal relief and damages. But Martin wants one thing.
I just want a solution. That's all.
But Corey Stern, one of the lawyers handling the lead lawsuits, says it can take years to resolve water quality problems in court. Stern was part of the legal team that successfully sued in Flint, Michigan. It's a community that, like Jackson, has made international headlines for its poor city water systems. He sees parallels. Both cities experience high rates of poverty.
Communities that struggle financially always have the least amount of resources. They always have the least amount of people advocating for them.
Jackson's crumbling water infrastructure will cost billions to fix. That's money city leaders say they just don't have. And there are similar environmental justice issues playing out in communities across the Gulf South. Last year, a federal civil rights investigation was opened in Lowndes County, Alabama. Residents, who are largely Black, have been dealing with raw sewage backing up into their homes and pooling into their yards for years. Investigators there are trying to figure out if they have been discriminated against by the county and the state. And in Louisiana, the majority Black residents of a former public housing project in Termé are still dealing with the repercussions of years of lead exposure. The city took 2 decades to settle a case accusing its housing authority of causing the problem. Stern says these communities are susceptible to harm because the city governments are juggling so many issues.
If you live in a community like Flint where the murder rate is the highest in the state, do you put your money into lead in water when you can't even see it or taste it or know it?
And Stern doesn't think systemic failures are always intentional.
I don't think someone got in an office and said, let's poison the heck out of Jackson. But the folks in Jackson are a victim of circumstances that in many ways are beyond their control, and it's the same in Flint.
Stern hopes the Jackson lawsuits won't take as much time to be resolved as in Flint. Community members there waited for 7 years. Earlier this month, during the height of Jackson's current water crisis, Michael Regan, the administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, visited Jackson. He highlighted yet another issue, climate change. Extreme weather will be even harder for cities with fragile water systems to deal with.
We have to be able to look at the repairs that need to take place on a normal basis, but we also have to begin to make investments to ensure that not only we build functioning water systems, but that they are more resilient to the types of storms that we're seeing as we move forward.
But getting cities like Jackson to plan for climate change is a big ask, especially as the list of water-related lawsuits continues to grow. For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Danny MacArthur.
The Gulf States Newsroom is a collaboration among public media stations in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Thanks to our guests, attorney Jean-Paul Larrison, LSU Libraries Exhibition Manager Leah Wood Jewett, and Associate Professor at LSU's College of the Coast and Environment, Tracy Quirk. Our Managing Producer is Alana Schreiber, our Digital Editor, Caitlin Omholtz. Our Engineers are Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Procell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7:30 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And before we let you go, a quick reminder that this week is our fall membership drive here at WWNO and WRKF. So if you like listening to Louisiana Considered and all the other programs we offer, then you can support us with a one-time donation or by becoming a sustaining member. Go to WWNO or WRKF.org to find out how you can support our stations so that we can keep bringing you the kinds of stories you like to hear.